that I have probably been to, well, a half dozen, seven, eight, maybe, of lunches over there. And there's been many, many more than that. And most of the times that I've gone to them, there's been 8 or 10 people. Most recent one, the one at Fuddruckers not too long ago, there must have been 30 people, 30, right. 35 people. I don't know exactly how many.
Yeah.
The one just, was that just before or just after Christmas? I can't remember, but it was in, over the holidays.
Yeah.
It was a humongous turnout, and it was announced like 2 days before.
Yeah.
And my wife will look at me, and you know, and the bulk of me, although there has been a couple over in the St. Charles area, my wife will look at me and she said, you're going to drive all the way down to Webster Groves or, you know, wherever right. for lunch? Yeah.
How about Groupons? Do you participate in any of the Groupons?
I really haven't done but a couple of those over the years. I did have done an awful lot of cashing with Leroy and Norm V. And the three of us have about exhausted the caches locally.
Hmm.
So by the time a group hunt comes up, we've usually already done those. And I have tagged along on a couple that I've done, though that's kind of fun to do. It's fun if you're doing one cache in particular that you've already done.
Hmm.
But it's not fun to tag along on five or six that you've already done. Or it's not for me anyway.
Okay.
And so I haven't done very many of them. Okay. Now, recently, I kind of slowed down hunting here recently. I don't know why. After I hit 2,000, I hit the wall, as the runners say.
Right,
I lost interest.
Yeah.
And that basically is probably a little unfair. I was in Kentucky. My mom had passed away, and we were trying to settle her estate, and I hadn't had a chance to do any caches in several weeks or even months. And I one day decided I was going to go out and do some. Had some free time. I was in Lexington. And I was not even realizing I was close to 2,000. I didn't know the exact number I had. And I picked 8 or 9 out that were all in one little locality. And I went out and I did all of those. And I came back and logged it and realized I had 2,000. And I realized that my 2,000th find was at a drive-up Slurpee ice cream freeze underneath the teller's window in a magnetic key case that I never got out of the car for.
Uh-huh.
The place was open, and I drove up, and I in line, and reached under there and got it, and the lady says, oh, you're finding the geocache. And I signed the log and put it back. And I thought, is that's what geocaching has turned into.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of lost interest
yeah.
for a while.
I hit the wall about 700 or so, but then after a brief amount of time, came back.
I was at about 750 when I started caching with them, and they were... Leroy was about 500 and Norm about 300. And they pushed me to get everything around here
mm-hmm.
until I got the 1,000. And then I was really enjoying it. And I don't know, I just kind of hit the wall at 2,000 because I was still going strong after that.
Mm-hmm. Once I hit 1,000, it's almost like a relief. I let the monkeys off my back.
Yep.
I've reached it. Now I can geocache in peace and not be rushed by this silly goal to reach a certain milestone. Numbers are meaningful in some respect, maybe personally, but when you start comparing it to other people, you know, people have different habits, they have different lives, they have different goals, they live in different places, whether you can get out a lot or a little bit, or whether you never do the easy ones, you always do the 3-milers. You can't really compare those numbers all together in one place.
The only person I'm competing with is myself. I pay attention to the numbers, obviously. But the numbers aren't what drives. I mean, I have several other hobbies. But geocaching is the only one that gets me out, traipsing around, chasing and doing things. And it's not, and it beats sitting at home, watching TV. I'm retired. It beats sitting at home. You can't go fishing every day. You can't play golf every day. You can't play racquetball every day.
Are those your other hobbies?
Yes.
Okay.
And you can't do those things every day. And geocaching fills a very nice niche for me. But I've learned that finding that little box is only one little aspect of it. Leroy and Norm, in particular, what I've enjoyed is us deciding we're going to go to Springfield, Illinois tomorrow, as an example. And we do a web search, and we find that there's 25 caches up there. That doesn't mean we're going to do 25. That the planning involved in the trip up there in the route that we're going to take around town to do this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one is more appealing to me than actually finding the cash.
Yeah, the excitement of planning and how we're going to do this in the most efficient way. And
right, absolutely.
We're going to get there as soon as the sun comes up and get the last one before the sun goes down.
And we've done some of those. But that planning, to me, is as important, if not more, than the actual finding of the box.
You say you are basically paperless. You do not do any printouts. Do you have the PDA? And
I would like to be paperless. I have a PDA. And I've had it for several years. In fact, I had it before I started geocaching. And maybe that's my problem. Every time I get out someplace and I really want it to work, the screen freezes up on it. So if I am on the road and we're in Tulsa, as an example, and I don't have a piece of paper on me and I have my little PDA, the screen freezes and I have all these numbers in my GPS and no information about it. And I do resets and I do resets. So what I have now come to do is if I know where I am going, I will print the 8 or 10 sheets that I'm going to go. And so I'll back it up with the other. If I'm going out on vacation to California, to San Diego, I don't want to print 50 or 75 caches that I might do or may not do. So I'll take the PDA if it works. Mm-hmm. I find some of those caches. If it doesn't work, I don't go. I use GSAC.
Okay.
I think it's... Now, once again, I'm a little hamstrung with a lot of the geocaching software. I use a Macintosh computer. In order to use the really good programs like Cachemate and GSAC, I have to use Virtual PC.
Mm.
And Virtual PC is painstakingly slow operating within the Macintosh environment. But GSAC is worth it. I tried it, and instantly I saw the advantages of being able to sort and to plan with the list and what have you, and mm-hmm. to print out one piece of paper that's got a lot of information. And in fact, is just recently, at the Fuddruckers luncheon, another good reason for going, by the way, besides eating, is Bruce and Happy Kraut both gave me some ideas on how to use the printout sheet in lieu of have one sheet. If you're going to do 8 or 10 caches, get on GSAC and print the hints and some of the comments in one little form, and you have one 8.5x11 piece of paper with 8 or 10 caches on it. It's got all the info. Well, I've tried that. It's a wonderful.
You print it out in grid form.
But I still wanted to have the hint, and I still wanted to have, if there was any unique things, the way they have shown me how to do it into the comments section, You can cut and paste all that information in. I remember one of your caches that had three or four photographs that were down here in the Route 66 park.
Right.
And you had to go find that particular...
Yeah. Casper 66.
Yeah, that was a very unique...
But you did have to have the images.
You had to have the images. No. But I printed those. See, right. I took those and held them up in front of me as I found it.
Yeah. That was actually a pretty fun one.
I thought it was a very nice one.
Do you mind talking about your heart and
that?
Oh. I guess go back to the point of what caused you to need the heart implant and how does it affect your geocaching?
It's not a heart implant.
Oh, I see. It's a pacemaker, Vice President, right?
Right. It's the same device that Vice President Cheney has. It's a implantable defibrillator. Hmm. It's a shocker. It's the same thing that you see the EMT guys put the two paddles on the guy's chest. And only this has got a little box that's got a capacitor in it, a battery and a capacitor, and two leads that run down into the center of your heart. And if your heart gets out of whack, it senses it and goes kabam.
Automatically.
Automatically. And sends an electrical charge to the heart. The first time that I had this occur, I was up in Washington, D.C., on business, and I think as I was staying a few miles outside of town in a little resort area, cherry blossom season up there, and all the windows were open. And I woke up about 2 a.m., and I realized I was very short of breath.
Hmm.
And I'm allergic to several things. I have some allergies, and I was convinced it was because I was allergic to all the cherry blossoms that were blooming. It was like in April. And I closed the window on the motel room, and turned on the air conditioner and laid down and realized I couldn't lay down and breathe.
Mm.
And this went on for about an hour, and I said something was wrong, and so I called the desk, and they got me with the 911 folks, and they came and took me to the emergency room, and they played around with it a little while, and I mean, I was still able to maneuver a little bit, but I couldn't walk a couple of feet. Hmm. And they decided to put the paddles on me, and they whammed it, and then I was okay.
It wasn't pollen from the cherry blossoms. It was some type of heart arrhythmia.
It was a heart arrhythmia. I have ventricular tachycardia.
Okay.
And I had that episode, and they decided that that was an isolated incident and so forth and so on. And then later I had another incident, and they decided I needed to have the device installed.
Okay.
And it's helped me on 10 other occasions.
So you have no idea when it's going to happen?
I have no idea.
You feel ill just prior to it? Or?
No, I have never felt any.
So you can be sitting there and all of a sudden,
bam! My wife says, what happened?
Wow. A matter of the heart getting out of rhythm?
Yes, it gets out of rhythm. The only limiting factor is the defibrillator starts doing something at 120 beats per minute. The defibrillator senses a rapid rise in heart rate, and it starts trying to control it, like a pacemaker, trying to drive it down. So I get out trying to climb a hill, and I don't want to exceed that 120. Well, they've helped me now with medications, so I take a medication that really holds my heart rate down. My at-rest heart rate is about 40. Now, you think that's...
Wow.
Yeah.
That's better than a well-conditioned athlete.
That's right. Although I don't have the well-conditioned body or heart. And so, therefore, now I start up the hill with you. And I get up the hill, and my heart's up to 85 or 90 beats, and which is where they want it to be. But it's not sufficient to pump enough blood. I go up in steps. I go, I go until I start sensing it, that I'm getting a little too high, and I just stop and rest for a minute or two, and then I go on. It's not really been any limitation other than mentally for a while. I don't know exactly how many states. I have done caches in, we went and did a trip to New England a couple of years ago, in Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont. I just did a couple in each one.
Okay.
Just to say I've done that, just to have that on the log.
But when you travel, are you traveling specifically to go caching, or you happen to be on a trip and you might cache along the way?
My wife and I have never traveled on a geocaching trip. And this is for her benefit that I'm saying this. That doesn't mean that when we are going off on one of these safaris, that I don't do a little secret planning in the background. And if there's a rest area cache, I stop and do it. And once we've settled down in a motel for the night, I may go out and do 4 or 5 in that city. But that's not the reason for going.
Okay.
Now, that being said, Leroy and I, in particular, have done an awful lot of traveling where we have gone for a reason. We've gone out to Springfield, Illinois, Missouri, and we've gone out into Oklahoma on trips, and Kansas into trips, things like that. St. Louis area caches offer you the largest variety of caches of anything I've seen. There are the easy picking, jump out of your car in the city park, go find it. There are the ones that take you on a 2 or 3 mile hike in some of the most pristine places in the world. You're back in the woods. There are the challenging, puzzle type caches. There are the ones that require you to use your GPS to, other than just follow the needle, to project a waypoint and do other things and use other systems of UTM and things like that.
Right.
Most of the places that I have done have been in cities. Most of those are just city park ones or virtual, easy. They don't seem to have the quality of caches that we have here. I will say that we were down in Florida in Fort Myers, and I did a bunch down there, and it seemed to me like that some of the areas that I went to were very beautiful areas, and I kept hearing alligators every place I was at. And it made me want to find and get out. Down there was a lot of pristine areas that were very nice to go see and what have you too.
Have you done desert caches?
I've done a few desert caches out in Lancaster, California, up at Edwards Air Force Base, in that area. And those make you really think, because you walk out in the desert and there's a Joshua tree or a cactus, is all you see. And I've lived there over the years. I've lived out at Edwards on four occasions. And I know that's where the snakes hide out. Mm. And I am, as Leroy or Norm will tell you, I'm deadly afraid of snakes. Mm. And so I get up with a stick, and I poke around, and I give it a whiff and a promise, and if I don't see the cache right off, I don't go delving any further.
I would think that in 2,000-plus caches, you probably have had a few stories where somebody says, you know, you can't be there, you shouldn't be there, what are you doing there?
You know, I've only had two instances, and one of them involved Leroy and didn't really involve me. But we were in a little park right next to a school, and there was a cache hidden next to the school. I'd already found it. When I get there, here is Leroy in everything but handcuffs. And he's got a cop in his elbow, and he's showing him his ID and all. And I walked up and kind of corroborated his story. But Leroy had been seen by the school people, the school teachers, outside the window of the school building, wandering around in the woods about 100 or 200 or 300 feet away. And they wouldn't know what that old man was doing there. So they called the cops, and the cops came out and asked him, and he told them. And the cop wasn't buying much of his story until I walked up and told, you know, had exactly the same story, a GPS in my hand, and the printout of the cache, you know. And then the guy let us go. You know,
so he actually saved Leroy from jail.
Well, I don't know about that. I think he'd about talked his way out of it by that time. Uh-huh. The only other time, I was down in Lois and I had stopped to do one down in Forest Park. And I came out of one of those little hiking trails to where she was sitting in a car. And there was a cop standing there. I mean, a cop. He was a park police. Uh-huh. He said, "What are you doing down there?" And I said, "I'm geocaching." He said, "We have a lot of bad stuff going on down there. You prove to me." So he said, "You prove to me you're not up to something down there."
Hmm.
And I felt like I was going through the third degree. I mean, you know, I said, "Hey, my wife's sitting right over there." He said, "I don't care where your wife's sitting." To make it worse, I did not have a GPS. I had already found it. I had brought it back to the car. Because it was raining. That's right. That was another thing. It was raining. And I had sat in the car, signed the log, done the little box, taken it back, hidden it back where it belonged, and was on my way out. So I had nothing. So I finally took him over to the car, showed him my GPS, showed him the paperwork on, and took him to the cache.
Wow.
And showed him the box. And that's when he said, "Okay, I guess you're okay." I don't know what he thought I was doing. I won't go into that.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something, and others have commented on this. I don't feel comfortable going to a playground in the middle of the afternoon when there are small children and a couple of mommies around and sniffing around right close to the playground equipment.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm on the other side of the park, I don't have any problem. But if I drive up in the parking lot and my GPS tells me it's going to be in a swing set or in a chair or in a device right close to where those people are, I will get up, I will leave.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to be around that kind of situation.
Right.
And I can understand, you know. Now, if my wife is with me, that's a different matter.
Yeah.
If that's an occasion where I'll say, "You've got to go with me."
Yeah, nobody questions a man and a woman.
That's right.
But a man by himself, you know, a middle-aged white man.
Oh, an old man like me. I personally don't think caches ought to be hidden in that vicinity. I did one of our GSs many years ago, 2-3 years ago, that was under a bridge on Interstate 44. And you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not being familiar with this area, you know, I live in St. Charles. I don't get down here very often. And if I did, I was going to Six Flags or something like that. I wasn't looking at all these back roads and the parks down here. By the way, I'll add that the parks down here are wonderful. I never knew they existed. Geocaching has brought me to all these wonderful areas, Greenspelfer, Emmenegger. I finally locate the little side road that runs along the side of the interstate, get there, find this parking spot. I think it's a parking spot anyway. And I start down this little road that's going to go down to where the bridge is. And I realize after I drive down there, there's no place to park down there. I better drive back up and park up on the top. So I do, and I park my car. I walk down there. I finally locate the cache, which is all the way back up on the very edge of the bridge. And I'm up there filing the case, signing the log, and I hear something going clippity-clop, clippity-clop, and here comes three people on horseback.
Mm-hmm.
And they ride under the bridge on this dirt road. And then right behind them is a tractor pulling a big trailer of hay. And then behind them was a pickup truck. Well, I've got the road blocked up there. Where I'm parked, I've got the road blocked. And I'm sitting there. And so I quickly put this thing back together, and they don't see me. I'm very quiet up there.
It's kind of dark, too.
Yeah, it's kind of dark. Part. They don't see me. And so then I walk down, and the time I turn the corner, I see they're all sitting up there trying to figure out how to get by. I'm just sitting parked in the middle of the road. The horses had no problem.
Right.
The tractor and the others. And I told them I was down looking at the creek or something. I can't remember, but they weren't too appreciative of me parking there.
Yeah.
But I think that Rich archived that one because of the concern after 911, or maybe somewhere in that
right.
thing.
Yeah.
About anything around bridges.
You will not see any type of cache like that
again
in the future
because
of the restrictions.
I'll tell you, I will comment one thing. I think that I know that I've made a lot of friends in Salaga and met an awful lot of interesting people. And I have, personally, I enjoy the Salaga events better than the geocaching portion of it. I personally dislike going to a picnic and having to ask 100 people, do you have a cache in your pocket? I don't think those are real caches. I don't mind the event cache for attending the event, I think is a fine idea. But to put out caches, 10 caches or 40 caches for an event, and they're gone the next day,
right.
I think are absolutely wrong. If, after having said that, I've logged quite a few of them, just like everyone else. But my personal opinion is, if they don't stay, they shouldn't be there.
So they're not there long enough for enough people to get a chance to find them. You have to be at that event or be able to make an event in order to ever get those caches.
Absolutely.
Okay.
See, I'm going to say a very unpopular thing, and you may want to edit this out. I don't think the Muga caches should be loggable caches. If people want to attend Muga and hunt for things nailed to the side of a tree, that ought to be fine. And they can log a Muga event cache. A Muga event. But that's all they ought to be able to log. The rest of it ought to be for the attendance, the camaraderie, and the trophy they win.
Or so maybe they have prizes. You can still look for those temporary caches, but each of them are not loggable on geocaching.com. Maybe they go toward an attendance prize or an event. You found the most of them or the most difficult ones during the day to get a prize.
That's right. Yeah. That's fine. Well, I say, they can work for the trophy, they can work for the prize, they can work for whatever is given out, or just the honor of finding the most in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But they should not be a loggable cache on geocaching.com.
I think the controversy will still continue to be an issue as long as the main goal of everybody is the numbers. So those people who have already overcome that and still like geocaching for the goal or the challenge of finding that box in the woods, then I think they're the ones who are benefiting most from the hobby.
I have not attended any of the nationwide Woodstock,
Geo Woodstocks,
or whatever.
Number 4 coming up in Texas.
That's what I saw that posted the other day. And I think I might like to go to one of those, and I may do that. But I don't like this idea of setting up to find 267, to break the record of 267 in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll make another comment here. You can probably edit out. We have, Leroy and I and several others have chatted, I can go to San Diego tomorrow, and my son can set up all the caches that he's found that I haven't found, and he can drive me to every cache, whereas I don't have to worry about the navigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can put on his pointer hat and say, if I were you, I would look under that rock, and I can do 50 or 75. Now, I can't do 150 like some people can.
Mm-hmm.
Have I really been geocaching? Somebody puts me in a truck along with 10 other people, and we drive around the city, and somebody says, one of you get out and look under that rock and sign up for Team ABC, and you don't even bother getting out of the truck and signing the log. You don't do anything except ride along. Is that a loggable cache?
I think that's why geocaching.com kind of stays out of it, that an interpretation of what's a find, what's a valid find. How is one easy find where somebody points it to you the same as a find where you walk 3 miles in the woods and find it yourself? Right. Too much focus on the numbers. You can't make everybody happy.
You're absolutely right. You know, you don't have to find them all.
That's true.
If you
sit back and think about that. You don't have to find them all.
If you don't like the puzzle caches, don't do the puzzle caches. Yeah. If you don't like the caches that are 5 miles in the woods, don't do them. So then why do we complain?
True.
I shouldn't complain because I don't like the ones that are 10 miles in the woods. A couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, I think RGS was involved in Brownie Bear, and I offered some classes that I thought were very informative. Mm-hmm. I went to two or three of those.
Tune up and learn.
Tune up and learn.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I thought, you know, those probably ought to be revisited. I mean, I'm saying that. I'm not volunteering to do it. But those ought to be revisited. They were very good ideas at the time. And as people keep joining the organization and new geocachers pop up, sure, those would be of a lot of help.
Right. There's still a lot of people who don't know how to project a waypoint. And haven't had a need to, or haven't had a good venue to learn how to do that. Starting February, the Mad Chef is going to arrange one of those Tune Up and Learn sessions.
Oh, good.
And at least one of that works. You know, there could be more. This is more like I've been in geocaching for a while. I may have a lot of finds, but I'm not sure exactly how to find caches on a route in an arc inside of GSAC.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that...
I don't know how to do that either.
It's really interesting. It's really useful. I mean, it's going to save you time versus getting a big blob on the map and then slowly carving out the ones you don't want to get along your route by hand. So we definitely want to encourage that and expect to see a couple of those classes put on this year. I may show up to learn something.
Me too. Absolutely. Because, hey, I'll tell you, you know, you can find thousands of caches, but you can also learn something every time you sit down, go to lunch. You learn something from one of the guys that are there,
right.
Or gals.
Right, learn from their experience.
Right.
Well, John, I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and do podcast number 9.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you for asking me.
Sure.
This concludes the Slogga Podcast. For more information about the Slogga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.